From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we meet Hartford resident Buck Blodgett, who works tirelessly for a cause his late daughter championed.
She was a really brave young woman, and she had causes. And ironically, her last and biggest cause in life was violence against women. She tried to tell me about it, and I listened, but I didn't get it until it happened to her.
Then we'll enjoy an in-studio performance of a Beethoven duet for viola and cello.
It's challenging to play, and the kind of integration of the two instruments is so brilliant.
Yeah.
He's just jumping about.
It's very well done. It has some technical difficulties, but in the end, it just works together.
And comedian Lewis Black rants in advance of his ranting at the Pabst Theater later this week. Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the summer of 2013, 19-year-old Jesse Blodgett was a student at UWM's Arts Music Education program. Those who knew Jesse would say she wanted to change the world through music. She had developed a keen social conscience, and it was her final cause, working to end male violence against women, that ended her life.
On July 5, 2013, Jesse Blodgett was raped and murdered in her own home. The story shook the Hartford community and made national news. For Buck Blodgett, Jesse's father, it was devastating.
But 4 years after her death, Blodgett continues Jesse's last mission. He works to end male-on-female violence through the Love is Greater Than Hate Project. He also shares their story in his book, A Message from Jesse, The Incredible True Story of Murder and Miracles in the Heartland.
Blodgett joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share Jesse's story and how her death has changed his outlook on life.
She was a really brave young woman, and she had causes. And ironically, her last and biggest cause in life was violence against women. And she tried to tell me about it. And I listened, but I didn't get it until it happened to her. But she was kind of fearless and fierce about many social justice issues.
You say, ironically, this was her last crusade. So briefly explain what happened to Jesse that so abruptly ended her life.
Yeah, well, it was a Monday morning, about 9 a.m., July 15th, 2013. Joy, my wife, was at work. I was at work. Jesse was home alone, sleeping in her bed. A friend let himself in our home, went upstairs, and attacked Jesse in her sleep. It was a long-planned attack. He hog-tied her. He gag-balled her. He taped ventilation tape around her face and head to hold the gag ball, and then he raped Jesse. And when he was finished, he put a rope around her neck and strangled her to death.
Many people found this, for anyone, it's a shocking event, but the Hartford community especially found it shocking, and even more so that it was a friend of Jesse's that neither you nor your wife would have suspected.
There's no word for the level of disbelief and it's just incomprehensible that somebody, especially a friend, someone who's known her for 6 years and sat next to her in school for 6 years and hung out and considered himself a friend of hers and was welcome in our home, that somebody could do that. Shock doesn't come close to saying the bomb that went off in our community and in my family. And I don't know what it is in us that allows us to do such a thing to each other, but it happens every day and we have to figure it out.
Now, what you've garnered attention and good cause for is how you've turned this tragedy into a call to action and in a way carry on Jesse's message and her personal mission, one of many. And in particular, it's been a little over 4 years, and since then, you've written a book called A Message from Jesse to recap the events of her death and the trial following all that you and your wife, family, and friends have gone through, but also her murderer's family, what they've gone through. It's a deep and personal look at these events surrounding it. But one thing you mentioned in the beginning is that you did it from memory. So why did you choose that route in particular, technically? And what was it like for you to embark on a book for the first time? Because professionally, you're a chiropractor.
Well, I don't want to be an author. And things started to happen to me, honestly. The morning after, I had this odd encounter with a butterfly. And I told a bunch of people about it because it struck me. And then there were a series over the next half a year of about a dozen more involving other people, not just me. And people would tell me their butterfly stories, and I would share them with people. And people started telling me, you got to write this down. You got to write a book. And I'm like, I don't want to write a book. I'm too busy already. I don't need to be an author too. And I'm not an author. And I still don't really consider myself one, but I consider myself someone who has a personal responsibility to share an incredibly powerful life experience that was so tragic, but from which something so beautiful came.
With this book, you document your personal turmoil, and many people, of course, are pleasantly surprised or inspired by your ability to change something that's such a terrible life event that can cause people and families to recede from social life, to lose faith. But instead, it seems like the opposite has happened. And I'm curious as how you went from a self-declared atheist, along with Jesse, you both kind of went at that decision together, to finding faith in this tragedy when many people could lose their faith easily if something like this happened to them.
Well, you'd think after 4 years I could explain that easily and well, but I'm still at a loss for words to explain that. It started with the butterfly the next morning, and then a 3 a.m. conversation in the hotel room that night with, I guess, God, with someone who I felt like I was 5 feet away from myself, watching myself have this conversation with someone else in my head or in my heart or in my soul, I don't know where. Which was an interesting thing for an atheist to do, is to be talking to God. But, Audrey, I still don't know how to explain it, but I had a very life-changing, profound, and deep experience of that everything was okay, even immediately after this happened. And the pain was indescribable and unimaginable. It still is today, 4 years later. But there's also something down below that that's even stronger. And it's that peace and that love. And, you know, bad things happen to every one of us. Nobody's getting out of this life without trauma and tragedy. And I'm no different than anybody else. We all have access, in my opinion, to this profound love and peace if we live with an open heart and an open mind and welcome it instead of retaliating or wanting to fight back or get angry or hostile or vicious or vengeful or whatnot. And when I didn't do that, when Joy and I both forgave Dan immediately, I was stunned to see how everyone else reacted to that. That's so rare in our world. I don't want to live in a world where forgiveness is rare. So thus a project was born.
With you and your wife, Jessie was your only daughter. And of course, this tragedy impacted you in a, I'm sure, a different way compared to parents who still have other children to take care of. And in the book, you state how your wife, Joy, was not a big fan of your newfound faith or other people's beliefs that, you know, kind of crowded over the empathy they were trying to portray.
Yes.
Has this dynamic changed for you guys or for her?
Not really. She's still her and I'm still me, and we each have our own experience, and everyone reacts differently to trauma, because we all have a different past and a different path and a different future. So I have to remember every time I post on Facebook, I have to remember, and I'm bad at this, I have to remember that I'm inviting dozens or hundreds of people to respond publicly to Joy. You know, everybody wants to help, and everybody has sympathy, and they want to support her and me. But she doesn't want hundreds of people, most of whom she doesn't even know, being a constant reminder and twisting the knife a little again and, you know, reopening the wound. And that's, I think, how most people grieve. I think I'm kind of unusual in my approach. I want and need and live to talk about what happened and try to do something about it. So Joy and I each have to understand that we grieve in our own way and do our best to respect that in the other person.
You mentioned how this experience has opened you up like never before. And mm-hmm. because a tragedy of sexual violence in nature happened to your family, you found people who either you knew for a long time or strangers coming up to you and opening up about their experiences.
Yes.
Along that line. And you note that it's attributed to how our culture is, particularly when it comes to male culture and discouraging openness about it. And how are you trying to change this dynamic? Because you've found such relief in sharing stories, and other people are getting a sense of relief from sharing their story with you and starting a conversation. What needs to be done in order to keep that momentum?
You know, first of all, I'm not an expert. I'm just a dad who wants to do something. So I don't have all the answers, but I found it incredibly freeing and empowering. When this started, I couldn't help myself. I had to talk about it. I just had to. It was so big and so bad. I've never been through anything that was 1/100th of what this is. If I would have kept it inside, I wouldn't have survived that first month. The silence was crushing when no one was around. I just wanted to be with people all the time. I felt like every person was sacred now in my life. People I'd always taken for granted, the friendships I had. Every word that came out of everybody's mouth mattered. Every second I had with someone counted. And then very soon, when I started to self-educate about this issue Jesse tried to tell me about, I realized that the number one barrier, the biggest challenge we have, is the shroud of silence and secrecy around it all. Victims, survivors are often shamed or guilted into silence, or outright intimidated or threatened into silence. And, you know, that keeps the perpetrator safe. And we can't have that. And it's up to men, in my opinion, now to, you know, when we're in the bar with each other or at the hunting shack or watching the Packers and somebody says something that, you know, if they said what they said about how many women they've been with or whatever, if they said that about your daughter, would that be okay with you? And if not, call them on it. Let's start a conversation about this. You know, we talk about reframing what a real man is, and men like to be brave and courageous. So we think that fighting and war, you know, that's how we express our bravery and courage. How about starting a conversation about what's not maybe culturally popular in your clique of friends? That's bravery. Let's talk about violence against women.
And this is your main goal of the nonprofit that was funded out of this, the Love is Greater Than Hate Project. And you mentioned this was Jesse's last cause and crusade, and you're continuing to carry on that voice through that. So explain to me what this project is and its mission.
We have a dual mission. The first half of it is to end violence against our girls and women. And the second is even bigger, and that is to have all people choosing love over hate. And no, I'm not crazy. And yes, maybe I am a dreamer, but I just have this overwhelming sense or understanding that I never had before this happened 4 years ago of how much we affect each other. Even the littlest things, you know, somebody brushes up against you in line and gets in your personal space a little, they're a little rude about it, or they cut you off on the freeway or whatnot. And those little things, they shape how we see the world and how we see people and each other. And if we let those things cause us to have a reaction, you know, Dan, the young man who killed Jess, he brought a certain something into our world and changed it forever. Well, now it's my turn, and it's Jessie's turn. Her voice is stolen, so now it's on me to be her voice and to be my voice. Forgive me, I forget where I was going with this.
That's but all right.
We have to speak up. Our voices matter. We have to do something about this.
This is it's always a timely issue, but especially the Me Too campaign has been flooding social media. It is, of course, part of the fabric of your project's mission to end male and female violence. And many women are coming out and speaking and starting that conversation, much like it was women that you noted who stood up against Dan in the courtroom that put him in his place and held him accountable for his actions. So What are your thoughts on the current viral Me Too campaign and how it ties into what you've been trying to do since Jesse's death?
I love it. It's, one of the messages in the presentation that I do for Jesse is find your courage, find someone you can trust. Not always easy in today's world. We've all been burned. So what? Keep looking. There's plenty of trustworthy good people out there. Find someone you can trust, find your courage, and then find your voice, tell your story, and you'll find your freedom and your power too. It's the shroud of silence that keeps this thing in place.
Part of what you do with your project is make presentations to schools, to prisons, to any public place that'll have you to share what happened to Jesse and how to change the epidemic of male and female violence through that. With that as a part of your personal growth, your presentations, writing a book, founding this organization, what have you learned from the people you speak to?
That's a great question. How can I possibly sum up? I've learned a lot of things from a lot of people. Number one, I've learned we're all different. We all see this differently. Number two, I've learned from the prisons, there's a lot of good people in prison. There's a lot of bad people who aren't in prison. And I believe we're all fundamentally the same on the inside, and we all want to be the best possible version of ourselves that we can. And yet we all carry around the baggage and the family histories that we do that shaped us and made us who we were and the choices that we made. But everybody, in my opinion, wants to transform themselves and grow and get better, including prisoners. Young people especially, their hearts are wide open. They haven't really totally formed who they are yet. They're growing and expanding. I love doing school-wide high school assemblies because there's so much energy in that room. And you know that some of those people are going to do big things in life. And many of them won't do big things. Mother Teresa said that most of us will never do great things, but all of us can do small things with great love. So I guess I've learned that people are extraordinary and that we do bad things sometimes. And I believe I've learned that we're all forgiven no matter what. I don't care what it is we did, including Dan. He's forgiven too. Just one guy's opinion here. Don't mean to get religious on anybody. And I didn't say we're all excused, and I didn't say we're not accountable. I believe we're here to face the darkness and to struggle and fight with it and to master it.
The problem of male and female violence is not one that can be eradicated quickly or easily. It causes a big shift in everyone's minds. What is one word of advice or perhaps an action others can do in order to create a better and safer culture? You know, what would Jesse preach for people to do?
I'll give you two words. Do something. There's a million things to do. Often it's just speaking up. Often it's just being brave and being public about how you really feel. You know, if we want to reframe what it is to be a real man, for many men, what it is to be a man is to be a father. Are you going to let slide some of the things that men think and say and do from a father's point of view? I don't think I love my daughter any more than any other father does, but I can't imagine loving anything. You know, I found out when we had Jess what it was like to love something more than life itself. And, you know, maybe I failed in my number one job in life to protect her. But I also succeeded wildly in my number one job in life to have her flourish while she was here. And, you know, we have to look at the environment that we're creating for our children to thrive in and to live and grow up in. And that environment is created by us, by our actions or lack of actions and our words and lack of words. You know, I just feel this overwhelming sense of personal responsibility now to be in this world in a way that's a contribution. And I hope everybody does. That's why I do this.
Well, Buck, I'd like to thank you for coming in, sharing your stories, sharing Jesse's story, and sharing your continued mission together.
Every time I get to talk about Jess, it's a gift to me. It helps me bring her back a little bit for a few minutes more. Thank you too, Audrey.
Buck Blodgett is the founder of the Love is Greater Than Hate Project. He's also the author of A Message from Jesse. The project is hosting an event of learning and community action in Hartford on November 9th.
The event will also feature a screening of the documentary Us Thereafter, which is about Jesse's and other stories about domestic violence. You can find more information about the event, the Love is Greater Than Hate Project, and Buck Blodgett's book at WUWM.com.
Cellist Robert Cohen is joined by violist Juan Miguel Hernandez next for a special in-studio performance for our On That Note series. That's coming up next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month in a series we call On That Note. We talk about everything from travel challenges to how to memorize music as we explore the life of a professional classical musician.
Well, we're changing it up a bit today because this month Robert was able to bring along his fine arts quartet colleague, violist Juan Miguel Hernandez. And when you have such high caliber musicians in your studio, talking is good, but a concert is much better. This is the duo for viola and cello by Ludwig van Beethoven. It's known as the Eyeglasses Duo. Thank you. Hey guys, hey. It is so great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Awesome to be back, Bonnie.
I'm trying to think, what has it been at least a year, Juan Miguel?
It's been a little bit over a year, yes, yeah. since I saw you.
So thank you for bringing me Beethoven.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Oh my goodness.
We talked about this over a year ago.
But I don't know, you didn't tell me what you were going to play. You just said we're going to have a duet.
Ah.
So I didn't realize it was going to be Beethoven.
Surprise.
One of my favorites. But I had never heard this piece.
Really?
Oh. Well, how often do you hear cello and viola give a concert together
right.
on their own?
It's a great little piece. It's a great little gem. And, you know, out of the few duets that exist out there, I mean, Hindemith wrote one, Piston wrote one. There's a few lesser known people that I don't even remember their names who wrote some. And I've tested them all. And I have to say, Beethoven kicks everybody's ass yet again.
There's something about his way with melody. Is just delicious. You mm-hmm. just can kind of sink into it. But you were having so much fun with that, too. Is it a fun piece to play?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's challenging to play. And the kind of integration of the two instruments is so brilliant.
Yeah.
It's just jumping about.
It's very well done. It has some technical difficulties. But in the end, it just works together. But that's Beethoven anyways, right? Any of his quartets, we're always finding like things that you'd usually say, no, that's just not doable on the instrument. And Beethoven just apparently back in those days, he'd just be like, well, I don't care. Just make it work, you know?
Figure it out.
So there's a couple moments like that, but in the end, it's all worth it.
And I think you don't miss anything, you know, with just two instruments in this duet. It doesn't feel like you're missing any instruments. There are any holes, or right. it could be better if there was a violin or something. There's such a fantastic range yeah. for both instruments and the depth of both instruments. I think you just get this very complete feeling, which is, for us, almost surprising, really.
And it has a very fun title, too. It is called the Eyeglass Duo. So Robert knows the story.
Well, I mean, he wrote it apparently for two friends who needed eyeglasses. So it's a with obbligato eyeglass. So in fact, that's quite appropriate
obligato.
In this case, because we're both wearing glasses.
Yeah.
And I am too, even though I wasn't playing.
Well, yeah, you're in the room. Well, everybody who's there in the same room has to wear eyeglasses.
When this piece is being played. Okay.
Yeah. Or else.
Yeah. Or else what?
Or else.
Oh.
Yes. You don't get the right perspective.
Well, this was a pretty early piece, too. I Googled it as you were rehearsing it, and 1796. When you were first playing, I was thinking, is that a Haydn piece? Because I hadn't looked at who it was, and I was thinking it was like a late Haydn. But no,
yeah.
It's early Beethoven, or relatively early Beethoven.
Yeah.
But you're starting to hear him stretch harmonically.
Yeah, it's the very beginning, because I did play some of his earlier duets for viola and violin, and really, really nothing to compare to this harmonically. It's a lot more strict and stable. And so this duet is definitely, what you heard, I think, is exactly what I observed as well about this duet. It's right at the cusp of his early years going into his middle life.
Going into that romantic, what we now call the beginnings of the romantic period. Yeah. You can hear it. But yet there's that classical structure too, which is so cool.
And also there's that real Beethoven thing, which is his obsession with beauty and power, those two kind of spheres that cross over. Yeah. And so
they're inseparable with Beethoven, I think.
Yeah. You get sudden moments of absolute beauty, and then he really launches in there, you know, with the two instruments. I mean, it's so much, it's almost polarizing that way, and then they merge those two qualities, which I think is always incredible in Beethoven.
Our On That Note contributor, cellist Robert Cohen, was joined this month by his Fine Arts Quartet colleague, violist Juan Miguel Hernandez. They perform Beethoven's Eyeglasses Duo for viola and cello. You can hear the entire piece at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, comedian Lewis Black doing what he does best. Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect returns now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Lewis Black is angry a lot of the time, at least in public. For the political comedian, that is part of what people expect of him.
Black's career in comedy is a long one, and it's interwoven with his work in theater. But for many of us, he first gained notice for the rants that have been a regular feature of The Daily Show, first with Jon Stewart and then with Trevor Noah. Younger listeners might recognize him as the voice of the anger character in the animated film Inside Out.
Since his origins in suburban Maryland, then New York City, he has been a staple of the stand-up scene since the 1980s, and that's what brings him to Milwaukee this Friday and Saturday night on his Rant White and Blue tour. We reached him on the line from New York. It is a real pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So you have made the point in other interviews, and maybe you'll make the point in this interview as well, that the President of the United States is a narcissist. Do you think at some level he's really into this idea that everyone is talking about him at all times?
I don't know if he's. I think he wants it. I don't think. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the complete pathology of narcissism, except that, you know, I've had friends who've dated narcissists. I have a tendency to date depressives. So I kind of have a sense of what they're like. I mean, it's whether he goes about every day thinking and hoping. I mean, I think he wants them to.
Right.
I think he really wants us to be thinking about him all the time. Otherwise, why would he be doing what he does?
Like it doesn't matter whether people are angry or happy or indifferent, as long as it is all that they are talking about.
Yeah. I mean, there's just no reason for a lot of what he's doing. A lot of what he's doing has nothing to do with being president of the United States. It has to do with directing the focus to him. You know, I mean, it's the same way he operated when he lived in New York. I mean, the one thing that we couldn't get through, we New Yorkers, because most of the United States thinks we're, you know, obnoxious and jackasses, and yet they picked the biggest obnoxious and the biggest jackass to be their president. They didn't listen to us. We lived with him. I mean, I spent 40 years making jokes about this person. From the time I moved to this city, this has been in my face. You know, and now he just has a larger platform for this. And then what I love, my favorite is that people go, you know, what I really like about him is he talks just like me. Well, here's the bottom line. That's the reason you're not the president.
As a topical comedian, are you kind of between a rock and a hard place then? You know, the idea that, you know, what he wants is attention, and at the same time, you can't very well not do Trump material.
Well, I mean, but I try not to use his name anymore. So I refer to him as the president or the topic, because I really... And I don't really like talking about him, but you're forced into the position of talking about him, in part because that's, in part, there's a part of my audience that shows up and really wants me to talk about him. I really make part of my act is making an attempt never to say his name.
I would think it'd be an interesting challenge to try to do an entire show without any references to him at all.
Well, I could do that. If there's so much going on. You know, I watch CNN for a part of each day because I think it's important because it gives you a good idea of what it's going to be like when you have a stroke. and what amazes me is how all of this stuff is going off, you know, that he's doing. Meanwhile, on the side, you have the head of the EPA is doing things that are beyond belief. I mean, beyond belief. You have a discussion of health care that is completely off the point. You have and none of the news seems to want to go into it or look at it or discuss it or the importance of it. The idea of the EPA is to protect the environment, and you have someone who doesn't believe in protecting the environment. And that's not up for discussion. It's not even up for a discussion.
Do you think it is I was trying to figure out the equation.
And I didn't even get to Betsy DeVos. I mean, so all of that stuff that's occurring on the side is really where there's a lot of comedy. But, I don't have the time to go and dwell on it.
Right, because at some level, people aren't expecting to go in and get 20 minutes of Betsy DeVos.
Right, and also because the news media is leaving it up to me to find the information and leaving it up to the people to find the information so that the setups that I need that will allow me to do the joke aren't there for the people to have access to. But all of the setups are there in terms of Trump. All of them.
I was trying to figure out the equation here. Do you think when you add anger and politics to humor, do you come out with comfort or catharsis, or what is it that makes this intersection work so well and not make people want to walk out of your show with an axe and start smashing stuff up?
Well, partly because a lot of people there's more blowback than there was before. So that it's isn't working as well. Part of it is that I think people always say I'm saying stuff that they would like to say. So there's a catharsis to the fact that, well, if somebody said it good, I can move on. And also knowing that there's, when the jokes come through, because I don't think I'm being that funny in this interview, but it really is like part of doing my interviews now is getting this out of my system so I can go be funny again. None of this is a shock. We've been through it on one level or another since I was born. But it's just become in the last, 20 some odd years, that it really is revved up. I mean, it was batshit. It was out of control when I was in college. In the 60s.
I was trying to imagine Louis Black in 1968, actually.
Yeah, I was crazy. But I wasn't crazy enough to go, I'm going to go blow up things, or I'm going to go do this, or I'm going to go do that. I was trying to write plays. But in the midst of it, I also was, writing some humor about it.
I was trying to figure this out because I'm a little younger than you. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, but in the late 60s, was there ever a sense? Could you see the light at the end of the tunnel that this was things were going to be different? 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the road. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's at play now is that people can't really imagine, what comes next.
Well, partly because we're going through a shift, and we went through a shift then. But the shift then wasn't as big as the shift now. This is a huge shift now because we're going essentially from a kind of industrial age, if you will, to a technological age. So we're going to, or an information age, whatever they want to call it.
Right.
So where there was kind of like the minor opening up of a culture in terms of hallucinogens. There's been the same in essence. I feel repetition of it in terms of the equivalent of the hallucinogen is your smartphone or then the internet and the computer, you know, which are extensions of your nervous system. And it was just dropped. We just dropped it on ourselves and said, hey, you know, okay, we'll figure it out. You know, they took away LSD immediately. But this, they didn't kind of roll it out slowly and say, hey, maybe we should talk about what all this means. Let's just do it. And what the result has been is staggering. Staggering in terms of its effect on a culture. But nobody cares. Nobody cares. So the people are driving down the street, and all of a sudden, they're literally somehow a text is more important than the traffic that they're in. Is anybody home?
I had this down in my notes, the idea that you know, we're sort of in this really addictive mentality, and it could be texts or it could be CNN and Fox and MSNBC on every place. I mean, places that I'm surprised that when I go to pick up my fourth grader at school, there's not a TV on with a crawl at the bottom of it in his classroom.
Yeah, what's coming? You know, I mean, well, you know, my feeling is when, you know, people always go, well, what do you think is the most important thing? I think public education. And I think that my generation dropped the ball on that.
Just in keeping it on the agenda?
Yeah, how tough was that? It was there. I had a great, I mean, you know, we talked about it. We were both raised in the same county. I had one of the best educations you could possibly have.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't an overly wealthy county at that point. There was just a solid group of people who wanted to teach, and then they tried to succeed, and that somehow it couldn't be sustained over time, because adults, what did the adults start caring more about whether their kid got a soccer scholarship rather than what was going on in the classroom? I don't know, but I find it baffling. Much the same way, my generation, which was schooled in a war that everybody knew at the end of time maybe we shouldn't have gone into, and in which tragically those who fought in it were not treated the way they should have been after the war, then you start one. Then my generation, with that lesson, you know, it goes, well, you know, the other war took place in a jungle, but this time it's in a desert, so it's different. So we end up going, we take none of the lessons from the Vietnam War, none of them, and go into Iraq. What? It really is beyond disturbing. And I knew it was going to happen. That's what really irritated me. More than anything else, it was like I've never been right about anything. But that I was right about. I watched, I said, they're going to do this. This same group of idiots. And they did. The group of people who should have learned the lesson didn't learn the lesson. And a lot of it had to do because they weren't in uniform.
It does seem like a lot of times these days in this business, the news business anyway, my end of the business, that you could almost write the stories about a year or 2 years or 5 years before they happen.
Yeah. This really does. They don't even, and what's really amazing is you could do that, and they don't do about it. They can't even get a grip on what happened today.
Right. Well, and the shelf life of your material, speaking of which, has to be a lot shorter than it was, because, you know, we're talking on a day, you know, the day after Monfort and Gates are arrested, but who knows what it's going to look like tomorrow or the next day or the next week.
And then they popped today was Papadopoulos Day, which is really great because, I mean, wow, that one slipped by everybody. And then, oh, and excuse us, here's another one. And there's something about it that just is eerily like Watergate. I know that people don't want to hear that, but it's weird.
Well, right, and I would imagine at this point, you know, all of the Scaramucci material is obsolete.
Oh, it's completely gone. It's really too bad. There's a really great, my friend Mario Cantone is a very funny comedian. Literally, could do Scaramouche. I mean, he literally went on the air immediately as Scaramouche, and could have, as soon as he saw him, knew, and he's, because it's right out of his act, practically, this guy, like a cousin of his. And it was like, I went, this is great, because, I mean, Mario's known for Sex and the City and a few things, but it was like, oh boy, this is really a great card for him to play. And then 3 days later, it was gone.
It's like having William Henry Harrison material, and then he's dead.
Yeah.
Political comedians in, what, 1848 or whenever that was. I want to ask you a quick question about how your comedy work relates to your work in the theater. I guess the question I had, because most people, you know, in the business would have done stand up and then maybe gone into the theater, and you went the other way. And at some level, you're still doing both. Do they scratch different itches for you?
Well, they're kind of the same, because what it allowed me initially to do was. Because I didn't think this would ever be a career, because I never felt that comfortable on stage for a long time. And so, but what it allowed me to do was write and get the writing out there. And that was what it was really about.
Do you think the audience, you know, I guess the question I was wondering as I was thinking about, you know, the experience you have as an audience member when you go into the theater versus when you go into a comedy show, is there a certain, you know, suspension of the world around you that takes place when you're there for that, you know, hour or 90 minutes or 2 hours that's similar, do you think?
It is a group of people who are really do sustain a reality together. In the same way, if you go to church, you sustain. We are all here because we believe in God. And we all believe, you know, when we go into the theater, we all believe that, that Willie Loman really is, in that hotel room. We buy it.
Well, so these many years later, when you are on a stage and you're, you know, channeling your anger at the world in a funny way, is it, I mean, maybe this is the most obvious question in the world, but there must be still a certain magic that comes out of, you know, making a room full of 1,000 people laugh.
Oh, yeah. You know, and there's still a certain sense of, I can't believe they're laughing. I mean, I've said it time and again. I go, wow. You know, people say, you know, for a while I was wandering around when I was doing the act and going, you know, I say things and people laugh. And, you know, and I know that there are those of you out there who aren't laughing because you don't think it's funny. And I said, you know what? I agree with you.
Do you walk off the stage and after, you know, after 90 minutes or whatever and just say, well, I guess I fooled him again?
Well, no, there's I mean, part of me, of course, always thinks it's not that I fooled him again, that there'll be somebody there who'll go, okay, enough's enough. We're going to have to take you someplace for quiet time. That's really what I think. I feel like, you know, I'm lucky. I've been blessed, you know, be able to kind of do this. I mean, it's kind of, and it's great because essentially what I've done is there is an audience that's out there. A lot of people don't get it. I get that they don't get it because what I'm really doing, a lot of the times, most of what my act is, I'm writing on stage. I have an audience that allows me to write in front of them. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, and there was a time, I mean, you know, you've been doing this long enough, that you were performing at a time when people, you know, didn't have their heads buried in smartphones, but also it would have been a lot harder to have that dialogue with your audience.
Yeah. And now I do, and if, as long as I've got, you know, that to me is at least a healthy way. You know, and it also gives them an opportunity to get stuff off their chest. And there's been a group of people who go, well, how come you're not doing your stuff? I do a 60-minute show. Then I answer questions. Then I'm basically doing what I do on TV when I read something on The Daily Show, or if I'm on some other show where they've given me something to read out of the teleprompter. I mean, come on. So what I've done is actually, instead of hiring a team of writers, I've asked people, you know, to write. And what's occurred is there have been people who've been writing for me who've become fairly proficient at writing and have gone on to write other things. So I feel really good about it. So, yeah, am I going to make an apology to you because I'm helping, you know, because I'm helping someone kind of get something off their chest? No. And I'm performing it, schmuck.
Well, listen, Lewis Black, it's been a thrill to chat with you. And really looking forward to having you in Milwaukee. And I hope we can talk again down the road.
I hope so. It was really a pleasure. And I always look forward to coming to Wisconsin.
Comedian Lewis Black performs in Milwaukee Friday and Saturday night at the Pabst Theater. Our conversation actually went a fair bit longer, and you can hear more of it at WUWM.com. We reached him at his home in New York. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It is 11 o'clock.
Flowers and my love hope never to come back.